The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
But you go back to China, you go back to Russia, we come full circle to the issue raised in so many of our client conferences and our Q&As. Will we in the U.S. retain the reserve currency status? I think the answer is a little bit like that to freedom or democracy. The answer is yes, if you can keep it.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, I'm talking to you remote right now in your fancy Airstream trailer. I got to tell you something, Dave. I know you've been to four states, and you're using this Airstream to keep the family with you while you do these conferences and consultations. But I'm jealous because when I was a kid, I wanted to be an astronaut. I mean, I was 6 years old when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon. And every time the Apollo astronauts came back, you know, they brought them up to the carrier, but they put them right into this beautiful Airstream and they quarantined them in there. So really, I'm jealous. Since I was a kid, I've wanted an Airstream. How is it?
Well, you know, four states and hundreds of clients later, our family's having a great time on the road. And the Airstream is a dream. You know, we've been telling hypothetical stories of cross-country travel in an Airstream for years. That's sort of one of our bedtime storytelling rituals. So I actually had to clarify with one of our clients. They knew we were traveling together as a family, and they said, well, that must be quite nice traveling in your Gulfstream.
Gulfstream, the airplane, the jet. Yeah.
I said, that's very, very far from reality. But the Airstream, the silver bean, the RV, is traveling well, and it's serving as a mobile office and is a classroom for the kids, and as occasionally a romp room for the wrestling boys, and always the culinary capsule three times a day. So it's been quite a trip so far.
Well, you know, legacy has been part of the message that you've had all along, and that includes family. And, you know, strangely enough, even when we have consultations with our clients, it's a little different than your normal Wall Street firm. Oftentimes, one of your kids is there and learning the ropes of what you do, just like you did with your dad. Dave, I remember, you know, I remember you as a teenager, but I remember some of your younger siblings being with us on conferences, you know, when they were 4, 5, 6 years old. And there's an awful lot that they can absorb when they see what dad does for a living.
I think it's surprising the ways that we learn by osmosis and the things that we might not in the moment be able to translate into propositions which are a part of our life. But I know that when I went to college, I had a different perspective on things than most people. And I attribute a lot of that to the way in which we grew up, which a part of that was traveling with my dad. And at one point, my dad was traveling a lot. 3 weeks out of the month was common, so 3 out of 4. And he decided at one point to get an RV and take us with him. And, you know, so I actually learned to walk in a Winnebago. And, you know, Molly McIlvaney, my older sister, myself, the German Shepherd, we did that for a long time. And actually, it worked well until 1 week we got lost. Well, we weren't lost, but I think my mom almost lost her sanity in Seattle, where my dad would leave and go to a series of meetings and the nonstop rain, you know, making more noise than you can imagine on the outside of the Winnebago just about drove her crazy.
So you guys had the first sleepless in Seattle. Well, you know, you've been to KC, Kansas City, the Twin Cities, Philadelphia, Charlotte. You're on your way to Austin. You know, you've got several more conferences to go, Orlando and Naples. And from here on out, you're going to have the family with you.
Yeah, in almost every location, there's a convergence of interest around the state of the markets and the sustainability of the trends that are in place relating to the markets. Obviously, an interest in metals and the direction that they take. There are also concerns about the underlying fragility of a debt-based economy. And a number of questions have emerged in that Q&A that we've had each time around the hydrocarbon-based economy and around a dollar-based global monetary system. And it's interesting to consider how those last two themes interact.
Well, and who would have thought that you'd be talking about U.S. treasuries with that? But, you know, the entire strength of the United States has been based on this petrodollar relationship with the Middle East, with Europe, the reserve currency status. In fact, you got to know a former treasury employee a few weeks ago. You've been talking at the conference a little bit about your conversation. I'd love for you to bring that into light, because treasuries and the support of the dollar really weigh into each one of the other areas, the debt, the hydrocarbon-based economy, the dollar-based economy, petrodollar, all of that. If our creditors are not buying treasuries, the dollar doesn't continue.
It was a curious, but I think a very insightful conversation with a former treasury employee stationed in Saudi Arabia for the better part of a decade. And, you know, the dollar's status on the world stage came back into view in this conversation. We ran into each other in the Carolinas. This is an earlier trip that I took through the Carolinas. But, you know, certainly, personally, as a proponent of gold, that idea of losing our standing as world reserve currency, that's been a theoretical discussion, a theoretical risk that's been on our mind for years. But to us, it's in the category of curious dinner topics on issues which can't ever be fully resolved, because there is a complexity and how many contributing factors are a part of that. There's almost too many contributing factors to figure out when and how that might happen. Maybe it happens.
Well, let me ask you, Dave, I mean, does it happen? There's an awful lot of talk on the internet right now about the loss of the dollar, having loss of reserve currency status, maybe to China. I mean, does it happen slowly? Does it happen quickly? What's it look like?
Well, I tell you, this conversation I had a few weeks ago, that's what made it particularly interesting, because, you know, we both shared the concern about loss of reserve currency status. And then I assumed that perhaps that because he was with Treasury, that that was a generally held position, that this was something to be defended and something to remain aware of. And actually, he said no. Quite to the contrary, the Treasury Department has shown little interest in the topic. Yes, it's an issue, but of such a long burn in terms of the fuse that it really isn't an issue to worry about in our lifetime. And I thought, well, gosh, I mean, that's a little bit like Janet Yellen saying we don't have to be worried about recession in her lifetime. What are we talking about here? And I think maybe it becomes that issue, like Hemingway's comment on bankruptcy. It happens slowly and then all at once, where the all at once, is it generations away? Honestly, Kevin, I think there's some current events that suggest otherwise.
You know, Dave, on that subject, because what we're seeing is we're seeing the rise of China very quickly. I mean, we see the economic rise of China. We also know they're the number one gold producer in the world, as well as the number one gold consumer in the world. So, you know, like your dad says, he who owns the gold makes the rules ultimately. But, you know, we're seeing reorganization from the top down. I mean, we can talk a little later about the reorganization in Saudi Arabia, because the two seem to be tied somewhat. But tell me a little bit about this China reorganization. It seems like there's a lot of cleaning house going on.
Well, you're right. It is a theme that my dad talks quite a bit about. And it's, you know, he who owns the gold makes the rules. He says that when you see a significant power shift on the international stage, it is usually preceded by a major migration in ounces first. Mm-hmm. And that gold serves as a part of the economic buttressing for a collection in of power. And certainly you can make that case. The gold is moving to China and perhaps the power as well. But we're watching a reorganization from the top down in China, driven by Xi Jinping, and he's transferring people out. He's dismissing people who are not on board. You know, there's people who are even disappearing. We don't know if they've been killed, but those that are considered in that corrupt category, you know, and of course you can define corrupt lots of different ways. There's the on-the-take corruption, the self-centered behavior counterproductive to the party's goals. There's that form of corruption. But it can also mean corrupt in the other sense, not a pure enough party loyalist, or right, perhaps you've got too much localized power allowing for autonomy from Politburo dictates.
Well, it reminds me of other house cleaning. You know, we've seen every administration throughout history do somewhat house cleaning, and they call it corruption. But corruption seems to be in the eyes of the beholder, or I guess in this case, in the eyes of the power holder. It may be just a loyalty squeeze.
Well, and you're seeing the same thing happen in Saudi Arabia as we speak with Mohammed bin Salman. There is a major shakeup in power there, and who knows what it's centered on, personal self-interest or for the greater family, that is the royal family, and their long-term viability. Only time will tell. But I'm reading a book by Walter Scheidel on revolution and warfare, and he mentions the hereditary nobles of the 5th to 3rd century BC in China. And this is the theme that he said happened in that same time frame. Transfer, dismiss, or kill. You just make those leaders simply go away and replace them with more obscure technocrats that owe their advancement in the party to, again, you giving them that opportunity. And on that basis, they tend to maintain a clearer vision of their obligations to the party line and those who are in leadership position at the very top. So in some sense, Chinese history is being recycled from the 3rd to 5th century through Xi Jinping and his administration today.
Well, do you think some of that has to do with this forward look on the One Belt, One Road? One of the friends that you have in China who's well-connected sees that as the major direction for China, Europe, the Middle East, going forward.
Absolutely. I think the reorganization has occurred over the last 5 years and will continue beyond today into the future. And, you know, really nothing and no one will be allowed to stand in the way of the revitalization of the Chinese people and country as a whole. And it's the ambitions, as you mentioned, of the One Belt, One Road project that can't be slowed by factions or groups of people that might want to try to milk personal benefits from the expansive development westward towards Europe and the Middle East. And that's, I think, in essence, what they're doing now. You have a purging underway, and the objectors are now able to see the cost of noncompliance. It's time to begin, at this point, moving beyond having cleaned up the house internal to looking at how you can negotiate with outside parties, interested parties to the West. And I think that's what we're beginning to see is the Chinese playing to those external interested parties.
Well, they seem to be playing this game like chess masters at this point. You know, they have their five-year plan. And then, of course, you've talked before about how they look 50 years into the future. One of our guests, Dr. George Friedman, he's a regular guest of ours, looks at the world sort of as a chessboard. And he talks about U.S. policy going forward. Some of his favorite presidents, you know, are Democrat, Republican. He doesn't really take sides that way, but they were the ones who had, they had a forward look to long-term U.S. policy. That seems to be lacking on our side of the Pacific.
Yeah, and I have to caution the listeners, my views on U.S. foreign policy are my views. You know, talking to Michael Pettis the last time I was in Beijing, it was interesting because he would say, actually, the U.S. foreign policy is far more sophisticated than we give them credit for, and the Chinese live with a constant state of sort of unsettledness about our foreign policy. So we in the West see them as strategic and insightful and ahead of the curve and thinking in terms of 40 and 50 years and executing those plans very well, while we see ourselves as incompetence. They don't necessarily see themselves as incompetence, but they certainly live with a greater degree of insecurity and see us with a grand strategy. To me, again, I say that up front because clearly this is just an opinion, but to me it's tragic that we in the States have no real grand strategy. At least I don't see it in our foreign policy objectives. And granted, there's a division in my thinking on this because there's a part of me that desires to be somewhat isolationist and have a minimal footprint outside our borders. And then another part of me that recognizes the reality that nature abhors vacuums. And if we're not the dominant player on the global scene, someone else would be. And I'd prefer to be closer to that place or locus of power. And, you know, the powerful today don't seem to know what to do with it. Again, that's my opinion, my perception. We have what appears to me to have been multiple administrations back to back, both Republican and Democrat, which are operating like short order chefs blasting grease fires. You know, they're solving short term crises, but with no real overarching agenda.
Well, and you want to be careful not to sound like a neocon either. I mean, you're really not talking about creating empire and maintaining empire, but there is a balance, isn't there?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't find myself cozy with a neocon group, but it's, you know, I guess I really don't know what to say about that because, you know, I want to scold myself if I'm sounding like a neocon. On the other hand, again, we look at power and vacuums that we can create. And whether it's the Muslim world or some combination of a Chinese, Middle Eastern, Russian axis, there will be someone to fill the vacuum if we create it.
Dave, September 11th seemed to really throw things out of balance for our strategies. I mean, we've been to war since then in countries that really didn't have anything to do with September 11th. And like you said, it seems like we're continually putting out fires, pulling troops out and then putting them back in. There does seem to be an inconsistency with policy.
Well, so look at what happened at the end of the Cold War and the fall of the Berlin Wall. You've got in a 10-year time frame, Francis Fukuyama saying we're at the end of history. In other words, we're at the beginning of a new perpetual peace globally. And, you know, 9/11 shattered that notion that somehow we are not going to have threats, that we will live peaceably in some sort of a quote-unquote liberal democracy. And clearly we look back 20 years and say that really was almost laughable. It was laughable, as well-intentioned as it might have been. 9/11, in some regards, has made us afraid of our own shadow, and it's created the very expensive impetus for the security apparatus, which is, well, it's supposed to protect the homeland. Mm-hmm. But I mean, the war on terror is in reality an excuse for government spending and an opportunity for private sector encroachment. And this is, again, I think you go back to that fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Cold War. There was no bad guys on the world scene to justify our overseas activities. And now, after 9/11, we've got everyone as the potential bad guy. And that gives DC the latitude to spend without apology, both here and abroad. So, I mean, it's almost an excuse for fiscal irresponsibility. And, you know, as the Keynesian would say, propping up aggregate demand, just ad infinitum.
Well, you know, we were talking about a Gulf Stream, okay, and laughing a little bit about that not being an Airstream. But, you know, the Gulf Stream jet has seatbelts in it. Now, that's fine. That's fine. If you land a little hard, a seatbelt's fine. But when you're flying 500 miles an hour, a seatbelt, if you were to stop suddenly, a seatbelt is meaningless. And so I'm wondering, Dave, if a lot of the security measures that we have taken, as expensive as they are really just like a seatbelt at 500 miles an hour. I mean, is it more perception than reality?
Sure. I mean, to draw another analogy, I think our homeland security is a little bit like the FDIC protecting bank deposits. Hmm. You know, not only do you have less than 10 cents of capital for every dollar in deposit, maybe that's more like 2 cents now. I haven't looked at the numbers recently, but it certainly hasn't improved since Sheila Bair left the head of the FDIC. But, you know, we live in an age of daisy chain derivatives exposure and G20 approved bail-in clauses, wherein if the banking community gets into trouble, they've agreed amongst themselves that they can pick our pockets. So, I mean, I look at FDIC insurance as effectively useless, kind of like Homeland Security, but it's a public policy success if people feel safe. What does that stimulate? Well, that's so consumers can fulfill their destiny as the spender of first resort. And that's what we're supposed to be. In the, you know, Ford envisionment of everyone fulfilling their role in the corporate machine, what cog do you fill? You're a spender. Get out there and consume. Do and fulfill your destiny.
Well, and I think part of the perception that we have built, and I know you and I have through our lifetimes, because the petrodollar, this dollar reserve currency status that was based on our ability to buy oil in dollars and force the rest of the world to buy oil in dollars, has allowed us to go deeply into debt. And so we can tool along. You know, you were talking about we're all spenders of first resort, mainly because we can go into debt. Now, a lot of that debt was supplemented or supported by the fact that we had somewhat of a monopoly on energy. Now, did I read right that Russia has now surpassed Saudi Arabia as an oil producer?
Yeah, you know, critical to who we are today in the world scene and what we're able to do is our relationship to Middle East oil and the petrodollar recycling which has occurred. I mean, keep in mind, the old school said you can't run massive trade deficits without tears. And, you know, you go back to Jacques Rouff's book and his discussion of the U.S. being able effectively to run a deficit without tears, and it had everything to do with the petrodollar. But you go back to China, you go back to Russia, we're driving Russia who in the last 12 months has moved into the number one seat for global oil production ahead of Saudi Arabia. We're driving them into the arms of the Chinese. Hmm. And we're to a large degree creating this cordial courtship environment for the Chinese and the Saudis as well. So we come full circle to the issue raised in so many of our client conferences and our Q&As. Will we in the U.S. retain the reserve currency status? I think the answer is a little bit like that to freedom or democracy. The answer is yes, if you can keep it.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We're treating Russia like we would treat, you know, almost a third world country with the sanctions and just our approach to Putin and Russia. With them being the number one oil producer, if they are being driven toward China, it seems to me like that's going to have debilitating effects for our trying to keep this petrodollar status.
Well, and that if you can keep it implies that you recognize that you may not, and you may have to be very intentional in order to keep it. I think you're right. We're not doing ourselves any favors. I mean, first, our disposition towards Russia. We've got sanctions in place, which have proved useful in certain instances, like in the case of Iran, where we were attempting to isolate and pressure them financially. They work great as a means to modify behavior with a given country or even to topple a regime. But we have not, nor can we, isolate Russia in the modern era. That's not going to happen. And toppling Putin would be a fool's errand. Second, you look at our massive increase in U.S. oil production. And listen, I'm not making the case that this is a permanent fact set. Just that as the facts are today, we're importing less oil from the Saudis than we were even a few years ago. And thereby, we're contributing to the creation of a new reality in the Middle East.
So we're taking the petrodollar for granted then?
Well, in many respects, we are. In many respects, we are. Forgetting that our purchase of Saudi crude is a part of a quid pro quo. You've got the petrodollar, which is directly tied to our reserve currency status, as is the security we promise from the external threats that the Saudis may face by having the U.S. military presence on the ground in Saudi and having arms deals with them, which kind of scratch both people's backs. It scratches the defense industry backs here in the United States, but also does the same for the royals, at least in Saudi Arabia, from external threats. But I think, frankly, it's the internals that we seem to be forgetting about. And that's in many respects. I mean, you look at the unintended consequences of quantitative easing here in the United States and around the world. And we have the obvious benefit of asset prices, for which Wall Street and the world's wealthy are grateful, because those are sort of your external benefits, the obvious benefits, price improvement. But the average man in the street is living paycheck to paycheck. This is certainly not the case all over the globe, but we can pencil this out at 78% of households in the United States are living paycheck to paycheck, which is twice the number it was in 2006. Prior to the global financial crisis. See if that makes sense to you for a minute. And these are folks that have a lingering sense of dread from the last global financial crisis. So you get the internals, which are not quite right, even as the externals of price seem to be just fine. Same is true in the Saudi state.
So Dave, in a way, we're behaving in a way that the old model is still working. In other words, the old model being that all oil flowed in some respect through Saudi Arabia because of their dominance in OPEC, and all oil was paid for in U.S. dollars. Now, what's happened is the price of oil has dropped. Our production of oil here in the United States has increased. We've got Russia now producing more oil than Saudi Arabia. And we're, like you said, driving them into the arms of China. So the old model's not working. I mean, could this be what's going on in Saudi Arabia right now, which up to this point has been a billionaire's welfare state?
And it's many things all at once, because at the same time, you've got lower prices, you've got succession tensions, in a reorientation with new leadership towards diversification from oil to other long-term growth opportunities targeted by 2030. And all of that takes time to develop. It takes dollars or reals to fund. And you've got all of the pressures that the people who are tied to the status quo are feeling about. And So really, you've got the extended royal family, which is not happy.
Well, and some of them are dying. Yeah, I hate to say it, but the helicopter crash last week at the same time that you had all of these corruption cases, we haven't even talked about the fact that 1,200 bank accounts were just suddenly frozen. And you had a number of Saudis who wondered from one moment to the next whether they were billionaires or complete paupers. And,
right.
You know, it was just with a single decree. And of course, the helicopter, I haven't really looked into the investigations on that, but you had one of the high ranking officials that was taken out, one of the princes that was taken out literally with a helicopter crash at the same hour that the bank accounts were being frozen.
Well, I can tell you that anytime there's insecurity felt on the ground in Saudi Arabia, whether it's the external type, which might come from the Russians swooping down from the north, a la 1989, or internal tensions and pressures where a number of people feel like they're not going to be able to keep their old cash flows, I can tell you there is money that goes scrambling into gold in the Middle East because they want something that is private and portable and going to be moved off of a runway in Saudi Arabia onto a runway just outside of Geneva or Zurich. And so, I mean, it is interesting. There's this huge irony in Saudi political turmoil because it is, as you mentioned, it's just a welfare state. It just happens to have a few more digits behind every number, but it's still just a welfare state. And in real time, you've got a political quagmire that the throne is trying to deal with. Why? Because again, there's not as much revenue coming in from oil. But it's no different than what we have in the United States. Political volatility is on the rise, and it is sort of in the rising of the tide with income and wealth inequality. Equality is never, I don't think it will ever exist. But when you have degrees of inequality widening, that can drive the masses to madness and to revolution.
You know, Dave, you talked about gold with the Saudi Arabian thing. And, you know, on Friday, I had to reminisce a little bit because gold had dropped. The price dropped to, it was like $10. It wasn't huge. But it turns out that there was about 4 million ounces sold into the market within a 30-minute period. It reminded me of the bear raids of 1989. As Saudi Arabia was preparing for the Kuwaiti war, they would come in and they'd sell 2 million ounces on the market, you know, on a Monday morning when it was quiet, knock the market down $20 or $30, and then they'd come back in and buy 4 to 6 million over the next few weeks. I'm not saying Friday was a bear raid, but it does seem that when money starts to freeze up, like you said, when people start to become insecure in Saudi Arabia and those oil countries around the region, you start to see strange things happen on gold, you know, a sudden drop and then over the next few weeks, a tremendous amount of buying.
I mean, my take is maybe a little bit different on that. And, you know, one of the themes that we have in the conference between my dad and I, and we look forward to meeting folks in Austin and Orlando and Naples, Florida here in the next few weeks. But you've got a massive amount of manipulation which has occurred from 2012 to the present and at key technical levels where gold, if it was trading in a free market, would have held. In fact, it got clobbered where you had massive amounts of liquidations at a critical technical point, breaking through those critical support levels and breaking down the psychology within the marketplace. What I love to see, though, is this. You go back, roll the clock back to 2013 and 2014, when this kind of dumpage of ounces equated to a $50 to $100 decline in gold. And then by the time, fast forward to 2015, 2016, the same dumpage of ounces equates to a $20 or $30 drop in gold. And now the equivalent, again, 4 million ounces is a lot of ounces and a lot of dollar value. And it's moved the market $10. I mean, what you're seeing is the diminishing effect of a manipulation attempt in the marketplace. And that's true. You can manipulate any market, and all markets are manipulated to a degree, but you can't do it forever because real buyers ultimately reemerge and overwhelm the volume of liquidations that you have, bringing stability to price. So, you know, I look at the world that we're in. I think we're moving toward a world over the next 3 to 5 years. This is not super long term, but it's of redirected oil flows. Check that box. Of redirected capital flows. Check that box. And are we not quickly moving towards a world where currency relationships erode or shift or alter in some way? You look at the Treasury Department today, and so far the U.S. Treasury has showed no real concern over our currency status on the world stage. Why? Well, we assume the limelight. Yet one of the pillars to our currency stability and therefore price stability is tied to long-term reciprocity with the Saudis.
Well, and not just the Saudis. I mean, look at Japan, China, the Middle East. I mean, they've been buying treasuries based on a model. A big part of that is a geopolitical model that's changed.
That's right. I mean, it's Japan, it's China, it's the Middle East. These are the buyers of our treasuries, and they've done this for years for political reasons. And, I mean, if you want to call it foreign relations reasons, you look at the same kind of thing happening now with the interest China is showing, not only in opening the gateway to the West via the One Belt, One Road project, but also in directly owning a big chunk of Saudi Aramco, the largest oil company in the world. And it's a clear message. It's a clear message to the international community. The Chinese ambitions of regional dominance and global influence, they're extending via the PBOC, the People's Bank of China, and through the subsidized investments which they've made throughout the world, continental Africa, obviously, throughout the Middle East. And this would be probably one of the largest single investments that the Chinese would have made. But Saudi is being courted by the Chinese at the same exact time we're creating uncertainties in our own relationship with the Saudis and in the region. Can't be good for us.
You know, it's interesting. If I look back at my adult lifetime, actually my entire lifetime, he who owns the gold makes the rules, but he who owns the petrocurrency seems to make the rules as well. And that's what we're talking about here. We've been calling it the petrodollar, just assuming that it would stay the same, the petrodollar. But I think we should start looking at calling it the petrocurrency and see who's actually, it's like a jump ball. Somebody's jumping. Somebody's going to hit that ball. Somebody's going to come down with possession. Whoever comes down with possession, that's going to change the face of the globe.
Well, absolutely. And this is a part of where history will not repeat exactly, because in past periods where you had global currency dominance, it was in a pre-industrial world. I mean, so go back to when the British ran things, go back to when the Dutch ran things, the Portuguese or the Spanish ran things, and oil was not central to the equation for currency stability. Gold was the only factor, and that basically created the financial backing and the financial footing, if you will, for banking and lending and trade. But now banking, lending, and trade have a lot to do with capital flows, who controls the flows, and who is inviting for those flows. I think gold still has a part to play, but oil is, as you say, a very critical component. You've got the One Belt, One Road program, which is a reason for hope. It is a vision of the future. And I'm talking about a vision of the future for Russia and for the Saudis, which would benefit from it as it comes to fruition. But I think this is where, again, we're taking some things for granted. U.S.-oriented unipolarity, this idea that we are the decision maker in the world. I mean, if not after World War II, certainly since the 1980s and early 90s at the close of the Cold War, that may go away, and with it, many of the assumptions we hold about U.S. domestic price stability. Because again, we tie that, we have that benefit because of our broad currency float.
Well, what that's allowed us to do, Dave, is spend money and borrow money without the need to really ever repay it. Because with the petrodollar status, with the reserve currency status, everyone who borrows money from us, they borrow it in our currency. When we borrow money, we borrow it in our currency. A lot of that's been supported because we did. We had the petrocurrency at the time, and that seems to change the model.
Yeah, so we go from a deficit without tears back to a world full of tears and people scratching their head wondering, what has changed? Did I miss something? Why all this sadness, right? We've got Xi Jinping, who's consolidating power. We've got Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. He's dealing with the Saudi Arabia, caught in the tides of change within not only the geography of Middle East Islamic tensions, the broadly speaking Sunni versus Shia conflict, but more specifically the Saudi versus Iranian conflict. And that's, again, you're seeing cracks within the hydrocarbon-based economy. You've got the old school in the Saudi royal family who see him as a danger and in the midst of consolidating power for personal gain.
Well, yeah, Dave, we've kept it somewhat economic today in the talk, but the Shia-Sunni war that has been continually going on for hundreds of years seems to be also a big part of this. Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Iran, the flow of arms to Hezbollah, all those things that actually our guest Kamran Bakari has given great detail on. It seems like we're starting to see those things come to fruition. You know, you talk about the financial moving to the economic moving to the political moving to the geopolitical or the geostrategic. We're seeing really all of those factors, especially the last two, coming into play at this point.
Yeah, and of course, things become more difficult in lots of different political spheres. And we see that in Saudi Arabia. We see that in China, and thus the consolidations of power, the purges, the cleansings, if you will, which is occurring here and there. So you've got cracks, consolidations, and this is really a pivotal moment in time, not only in the Middle East, but in China. And we have to be very careful. We have to be very careful about new trajectories that are being set, which may minimize our importance on the world scene. You know, coming full circle, Kevin, the conferences that we've done with clients have revealed over and over again the interest in what is happening from a broad perspective and at a micro level within each of the markets, whether it's gold, silver, platinum, palladium, oil. We've had some great questions on the oil markets, some fantastic questions dealing with derivatives, great questions dealing with the stock market, and just a really in tune listenership, readership, and audience at these conferences. And none of us knows what the future holds. That is the only certainty. We do our very best to remain appraised of what's changing and what the contributing factors are to changes and shifts within the financial markets. But this is absolutely one of the most fascinating times to be alive as an investor. You can assume nothing about what has existed and what may exist in the future. Specifically, we come back to this point of reserve currency status being at the bedrock of all that we know in terms of fiscal, monetary, and general economic stability in the United States. We simply can't take it for granted.
Yeah, even geopolitical.
That's right.
Well, Dave, as we wrap up, one of the things that I think most of the listeners and the people at the conferences have brought up is this artificial feeling of security. Everyone seems to sense that it's artificial. They seem to sense that there are cracks. Yet, like you were talking about with Homeland Security, as long as people somewhat feel safe, things will continue to the next day and then the next day. You know, your recommendation over and over, and your dad's recommendation, has been keep your powder dry. Don't buy into this false sense of security because things are about to change. Do you have a comment on that before we close?
Well, as boring as it may seem, the idea of keeping extra liquidity and in multiple forms, you know, again, I understand people are enticed to look at the latest, greatest way to become a millionaire. I am more inclined, as you say, to keep the powder dry and, you know, some combination of cash and metals as an offset to a mismanaged cash position by our U.S. Fed. I think it makes sense to create a balance there. There will be better days and better times to be putting capital to work for us. We live today with certain command and control dynamics in the marketplace, and that is a period of time where price is almost irrelevant as a data point. And with that in mind, it's almost impossible to judge what your risk reward calculus is. You don't have to play. You don't have to play. This is a time to be cautious and be ready. Certainly rehearse in your mind what it looks like to put those dollars, cents, or ounces to work for you, because I think we're within a very short period of time away from being able to do just that.
Well, from the road of the McIlvaney Airstream, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call, 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.